across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Well, I've got this programme for government. Good morning, by the way. How are you doing? Might be the afternoon, might be night time by the time you're listening to this podcast from the BBC. We'd like to give it to you so that you can have it whenever you want. So the programme for government, BBC, our colleagues in the BBC Newsroom got a leaked copy of it. And I'm looking through how much detail's in it, how much waffle is in it, how much have they filled pages with writing, which doesn't pin them down. How many times have they said after a year of getting this agreed, look at that, just random page. We are seeking. We will ensure the planning system supports the delivery. How is it in this? All coming up with the Nolan Show this morning.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. It's an important milestone, says our First Minister, Michelle O'Neill. She has hailed the agreement of a long-awaited programme for government by Northern Ireland's ministers. The document has been seen by our colleagues in the BBC newsroom. It'll have to be delivered to the Assembly first today before it can be published to all of you. The question this morning that we're looking at is how much of it is worth the paper it's written on in terms of delivering, actually having agreed real ideas, real goals, real ways of delivering to you here in Northern Ireland. If I just pluck one example out of this document, improving our infrastructure, says our government, will be vital to delivering our priorities. By investing in water and wastewater, roads and transport, we will encourage businesses to invest. But there's nothing in this document that says how much they're going to invest, when they're going to invest it by. Diddly squat. And in this document it says doing what matters most. You, the public, have waited months and months and months for this. You've heard business and investors talk about how vital it is for our government to come up with a solution to the water problem that there is in Northern Ireland. Developers can't build because we can't plug into the water supply. And months later, what has our government come up with? A line. Improving our infrastructure will be vital to delivering our priorities. So Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly and all the rest of you in Stormont, if this is a milestone, can we build more houses now off the back of this? Where? When? How? In terms of our justice system, their target by 2027, they will have, quote, progressed a speeding up justice programme and have an executive agreed approach. They haven't agreed it yet. They haven't done it. Look at the wording. They will have. They're promising to do something they haven't agreed. This year, quote, in terms of justice, we will, quote, explore options for expanding the use of out-of-courts disposals, including CRNs, that's community resolution notices, develop a robust business case. So in other words, none of it's done. It's not done. There's nothing agreed in terms of justice. What is going on? Where is the delivery? Gareth Gordon, our political correspondent, is with us this morning. Good morning to you, Gareth.
Good morning, Stephen.
I know you're reporting in the news today around health, if we take that as another example. The paragraph says, Gareth, with executive support, invest up to $135 million a year to reduce waiting lists. But that money's not in the budget.
Well, at least this, unlike the draft, which we saw on the 9th of September, does put a target in place. It may not be perhaps wide-ranging as some people would like, but nonetheless, it is a target that they can be held to account for. Don't forget also to the fact that this executive missed the first 2 years, or this assembly executive missed the first 2 years of its existence because of the DUP boycott, so they got another 2 years. Also, social housing, there is a commitment on social housing, a target for 2027, which is when this mandate runs out. They've started work on at least 5,850 new built social homes in Northern Ireland, and they've also pledged to publish annual reports on the progress they are making. So if they're not making the progress that they hope to make, it will be obvious for everyone to see, you would say. But the criticism, as you've really laid out pretty starkly, is that this is a bit of a wish list, and it's a bit general, and it's a bit vague.
So what took them so long to come up with all this vague stuff? What took them so long to agree very little?
Well, to put it another way, at least this executive, you could say, has agreed a programme for government. The last time an executive agreed and implemented a programme for government was in 2011, and it ran until 2016. There was one agreed, a draft was agreed in 2016, but it was never implemented because the Assembly collapsed. So this is a problem that successive executives have had. They've been up and down. There have been boycotts, one by the Sinn Féin for 3 years, one by the DUP for 2 years, and then, of course, COVID got in the way as well. So we're past the stage now where just basically being there is regarded as a success. We're long past that. They will say this is a success in that they've agreed this programme for government, but you will say, and others will say, with some justification, was it really what took you so long?
Policing numbers, another example. Massive issue for our society. John Boucher saying that he cannot sustain the service that he wants to sustain without proper policing numbers. So month after month after month of discussion in our government, quote, develop a robust business case that will seek to stabilise and begin to grow police officer numbers. No number in it of how many police officer numbers we would have by the end of the term. No amount of investment that they're even aiming for putting into policing, Gareth. Nothing.
Well, of course, John Boucher upset this executive early on by going over their heads and going to Westminster for the money. He possibly has very good grounds for that, because national security is a Westminster issue. So the executive are not totally masters of their own destiny with this concern. One I picked out is Casement Park, potentially one of the most contentious issues, of course, facing this executive now. Another one where they hoped basically they wouldn't have to make a big decision, that the money would come from Westminster. Promises were made by the last administration and not kept up. Paper states executive will make progress on the redevelopment of Casement Park, but does not include a definitive timeline for this. Well, that one probably isn't worth the paper it was written on.
Gareth, thank you. Good morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. Professor Deirdre Heenan from Ulster University with us today. Good morning to you, Deirdre.
Good morning.
Special educational needs, so vital to our children. So let's look at the detailed agreement that our well-paid politicians have come up with. We will have a comprehensive executive agreed SEN reform agenda and delivery plan in place. So we will have it in place. They don't have it in place. There's no detail of what they'll do. This year they say we will, quote, establish. Clock the word establish. Establish means they haven't got round to doing it. This year we will, quote, establish an executive agreed special educational needs reform agenda. Well, do you know what? For those children with special needs that are not getting delivery from this government, well, this document must do a lot for them. They'll establish it. What on earth have they been doing right up to now? Why isn't it established?
I think the difficulty is the draft programme for government isn't a draft programme for government. It's vague, it's unspecific, it lacks ambition, it's incoherent, and in many ways it's completely meaningless because it's devoid of targets. It lacks the detail on the interventions that we need, and I suppose significantly then it is impossible for the public to judge progress. We understand the programme for government should be a comprehensive document that sets out key priorities, measurable targets, indicators, goals, timescales and metrics. So it should be the strategic document that underpins this agreed vision for Northern Ireland, what this government have agreed. And really it isn't. If you contrast that to Scotland, for example, John Swinney sent out his first programme for government and he listed four priorities. But alongside that, he had a list of supportive legislation, a programme to say, this is how this is going to happen. And of course, for me, the particular focus is on healthcare. Many of us would would say that health waiting list is the number one priority. And yet, every time we get figures, when we actually are able to get figures, the health waiting list continue to increase. So one would imagine that that would be an agreed number one priority. And yet we have no detail on what exactly is being proposed here. This morning we're told that they will invest $135 million
no,
per year.
No, but you see, you're not being told. I've got the document in front of us, right? You're not being told that, because right throughout this document, they give themselves wriggle room. With executive support, right, they say, invest up to $135 million. Well, do you know what that is? Up to? Up to means anything between zero and $135 million. And the key point is, Deirdre, they put this in this document knowing they haven't got it in the budget. It hasn't been agreed in the budget.
Well, I mean, I absolutely agree with you, because we've had this conversation so many times where we're told that we can't address waiting lists because we don't have the money. Even if we got £135 million per year, even if they did achieve that, remember, this is out of an overall budget of £7.4 billion. And they say they hope to see 70,000 patients. And that works out about £4,000 per patient. So we're not going to see people who are waiting to get hip replacements coming off waiting lists. This is going to be fairly low level. And the real problem in here is there is no detail. Where will this capacity come from? Will we reintroduce the cross-border directive? And how will we know, most importantly, what success looks like? Gareth referred there to say we may get an annual review. Well, there's just 2 years left of this executive. And the key problem is there is no transparency. There is no accountability. We have not met a waiting list target since 2006, and people just shrug their shoulders. What we need to understand in terms of the waiting lists are, will there be a regional waiting list? Where will the priorities be? How will we manage to increase capacity? We've been talking about elective care centres for a decade, and it is very important to say that those elective care centres are not designed to address a backlog in waiting lists. They are designed to treat you if you turn up tomorrow and you say, I have a problem with my gallbladder. They are about the current, not the backlog. And when we listen to Keir Starmer saying that no one in the UK should be waiting longer than 18 weeks to see a consultant, 18 weeks on a waiting list, and we are asking people in Northern Ireland to wait for 10 years, then you really have to ask yourself, where is the ambition? Where is the urgency? Where have they sat around the table and saying this is totally intolerable? How can we talk about parity for people in Northern Ireland when this is what they are asked to expect? They're being denied a service, and yet they don't seem to have an idea between them as to what they're going to do about it. So in terms of the waiting lists, for me, what is really disappointing is that we do not have a detailed plan on how we will address these waiting lists, addressing those issues of capacity, workforce costs, and you're absolutely right, not saying we hope to have the money, saying we have made a decision that we are spending the money on this because it is an agreed number one priority that impacts on every other aspect of life in Northern Ireland.
If we, Mick Fieldy joining us this morning as well, editor of Slugger Old Tool. Morning, Mick.
Morning, Stephen.
So this is being presented by our First Minister as an important milestone. So let's just drill, before we leave health, Mick, let's just drill into more of the wording. You see in big, bold letters, this year we will. Right. So this year we will. And you think to yourselves, OK, they're going to tell us here what they've agreed going forward. Then watch what they do. This year we will. And then they do a new paragraph. Have invested 76 million to limit further deterioration of cancer. Not here's what we're going to do going forward. This year we will. Future tense. And then they go back to the past.
Okay, Stephen, look, you have a slight advantage on me in that you've got the full document in front of you and I haven't. And I don't want to be churlish and I don't want to be seen to be negative. I think something that Gareth said earlier on needs repeating. This is the first programme for government since 2011. That is an achievement and we should welcome that. Now, notwithstanding...
Are you setting the bar low, Mick?
No, look, for Northern Ireland, it's a low bar, generally speaking. You know, I'm not going to argue against that. But the point is that when they actually do something that we have been waiting all those years for them to do, I think we ought to say, well done.
But does it deliver real change?
Well, that's another question. And look, the thing, you know, I agree with almost everything that Deirdre said. You know, 10 years waiting for an elective surgery, especially if it's a chronic condition, which is only going to get worse over that period of time, is deeply unacceptable. But let's think about what a programme for government does. And, you know, my criticism isn't of the programme for government. It's the process that leads to a programme for government that takes a year of consultation. The consultation is the election. Then it's down to the political parties to take their manifestos, conjoin them and put them into a workable programme for government. But if we compare it with the Starmer government, which came in July, there was a speech that Starmer made just before Christmas, which the media all said was a reset speech. In fact, what it was a setting of specific targets for civil servants to get down and deliver the kinds of things that were in the programme for government. So there are step changes. The programme for government is a broad outline, but what we expect, if they're going to be able to hit the targets, and I'm really glad they have a social housing target for 2027, because then voters will be able to judge whether they were as good as their word and delivered those kinds of targets. But what we should be pressing for is to take these broad themes and see them translate those broad themes into achievable targets. Then we can tell whether they're a good government or a bad government. And that, for me, has to be the acid test going forward. We have the peace. You know, we've seen crime rates falling. We've seen sectarian rates of violence for the under-20s fall massively. That bit is successful. The key thing here is this a basis for good government? And in 2 years' time, will we be able to judge whether they delivered what they promised?
I think, though, it's important to say, Mike, that thousands of citizens listening to this are languishing on waiting lists that are longer than their life expectancy.
Yeah.
Lengthy waits, they place patients at risk of developing more complex conditions, and then it's more expensive to treat these people. And that's before you start talking about the toll that that takes on your mental health and widening health inequalities. So I would like to see more of how there's an understanding. We talk about economic inactivity and high rates of economic inactivity, to say that this is too important to be left to the Department of Health. This, to my thinking, should be the central thrust of this whole programme for government. And we should have detail about what they're going to do, how they're going to do it. I mean, how are they going to begin to address some of these long-standing issues? And when will we know what success looks like? Because as has been said, the tense is past tense, future tense. We don't really know what to expect. We're told, for example, that they have successfully rolled out the mental health strategy. Well, I would like to say that this year, the mental health strategy has been awarded 8%. 8% of the total funding that the Department of Health themselves said was required to roll out the strategy. How could you describe that as progress? Not only is it deeply disappointing for the people who've worked on that strategy, but it actually means we're going backwards and some of the money that has been invested will actually have been wasted.
A fuel poverty strategy. How long are we waiting in this document? A year? So let's deliver here from this document what all of that thinking in the Northern Ireland Executive, all of that thinking with our ministers. So let's see what they've agreed around a fuel poverty strategy, with so many of these political parties positioning themselves as fighting for working class people. Here it is. They will complete a public consultation and publish an executive agreed fuel poverty strategy. In other words, they don't have agreement around a fuel poverty strategy, and they've no notion, as articulated in this document, what it would look like.
I think that's fair comment, Stephen. And there's that C word again, consultation. The reason it's taken them a year to get to the programme for government is consultation. Now, these are political parties who consulted the electorate, 3 years ago? Why is it? Why do they need to go out and do a secondary consultation? The reason everything
well,
is
does it stall
so
time?
Long,
is it a stalling tactic?
Well,
sorry, I just want to say, I think the other thing to say is It is now, I hope, entirely unacceptable for our government to say we need more money. If only we had the money. This is dependent on more money. We have over £14 billion. The job of a government is to set priorities and then to decide what their spending is going to look like. We spend more than £300 per head on health and social care than the equivalent in England. So we cannot justify saying, if only we had more money. We have to look at how we're spending money and assure the public that we are spending that money well, and that we've identified priorities and we are doing what we said we would do.
When you say, Deirdre, we need to look at it, the public are paying these politicians to have looked at it over the last year. This is supposed to be a, quote, milestone. This is supposed to be a detailed document. Could anybody rely on this? On Friday, Northern Ireland Water said there's not enough funding available to deliver a number of major infrastructure projects for Northern Ireland. They said on Friday the severity of wastewater and drainage development constraints will increase as a result. So what do we get in this milestone document? There, the executive are basically telling us that there is a problem. They don't tell us how they're going to solve it. They tell us there's a problem, Mick.
No,
yes, but if our government are saying they have no agency, they cannot affect change, they cannot set a priority, they don't have enough money, then surely the public are going to say, well, what is the point?
I just want to read this paragraph because I know you haven't seen it, Mick. All right? So this is under the heading Building New Foundations. Let me read this to you, Mick. Improving our infrastructure will be vital to delivering our priorities. By investing in water and wastewater, roads and transport, and sporting infrastructure, we will encourage businesses to invest, enable house building, and support greater energy efficiency and affordability. We know that public investment alone is not enough, and we will continue to implement a planning improvement programme in collaboration with government and other stakeholders. Our goal is to make our planning system work for business people and the environment. Do they tell us how they've agreed to do that? No, they do not, Mick.
No, they don't. And that is, again, you know, you've got the paper in front of you. I haven't seen it yet. I do want to be positive about the fact that they've delivered it. And what I would say is, to some extent, this comes down to opposition MLAs and even government backbench MLAs starting to put pressure on the executive to come up with solutions to these problems. We know the planning process has got issues, but the bigger issue is the ability to deliver infrastructure, and that's all tied up with Northern Ireland Water, the way that it is, the way that it is funded. And there needs to be something, there needs to be some intention, clear intention for government to sit down, isolate that problem across, you know, they've got cross-cutting themes in the, as I understand it, from what's been leaked in advance, which includes housing and the economy. And Northern Ireland Water sits right across both of those vital issues, especially if the overall plan is to grow a globally competitive and sustainable economy, as they're promising. But it's down to the MLAs to start holding these people to account and saying, look, it's okay, but you need to be specific. You have 2 years to start delivering, and you have 2 years, less than 2 years, to put meat on the bones about how you're going to deliver this. And Northern Ireland Water, for me, is front and centre and how it is funded. There are issues with water in the south, but it's not investment. It's investment in trying to build a new modern network inherited from the old county councils. What we have in Northern Ireland is a good network, but we cannot afford to expand to meet the demands of a new economy, which is rapidly growing, and the housing that we need to put roofs over ordinary people's homes.
On the forward of this programme for government, there's Michelle O'Neill sitting beside Emma Little-Pengelly. They're both smiling for the cameras. They say in this forward to this programme for government, for every one of you, man, woman, child, listening to this morning, they say together, on taking up office, we promised you opportunity and hope. We pledged to be on your side and to work for you. We said we would show you that power sharing could succeed, and that under our leadership, this would be an executive of partnership and progress. The programme for government, they say, is all about tackling big issues. Working with our colleagues in the executive, we've agreed a set of ambitious priorities which will make real improvements across society, both today and in the years ahead. So Emma Little-Pengelly, Michelle O'Neill, every one of the rest of you as ministers, can you spell out here the definite progress that will be made on our water infrastructure? Can you spell out the absolute guarantee that you've made around extra investment in health to get people off waiting lists? Can you spell out for those children with special educational needs where you have sat down over the last year and agreed something that will actually deliver for those kids? In terms of our police on the streets, what number have you come up with? What budget have you come up with? What time have you come up with at which it will be delivered? And you know the answer? It doesn't exist in this document. Despite the gloss on this brochure, those things are missing. So what do the public do from here, Deirdre?
Well, I think the public have got to continue to put pressure on. So there is an acknowledgement within this plan that waiting lists are unacceptable. We know that. But there's a complete absence of any plan to address that. So what are the strategies that they're using to reduce the times for elective care? We are told in this document that the changes required will take time and long-term investment. It's not exactly a clarion call to action. I think this is really where the public need to say, this is not good enough. Yes, we are delighted that we at last have a programme for government. We are delighted that there's some effort to put in some meaningful figures, but it is too vague, it lacks detail, and we really want to know what is going to happen at the end of 6 months, what will happen at the end of 12 months, and at the end of this term, how will we know that success has been achieved? And we cannot possibly do that without the metrics, without the timescales. How will they prioritise waiting lists? What will they do for people who've been waiting the longest? These things could happen and could happen quickly. But what is not acceptable is to say we have to put up with this because we need more money. I think really it is time for the media and the public to push back at that and say, you have money. You just need to set priorities. We cannot continue to do what we have been doing and expect to see any fundamental differences in healthcare.
Okay, Deirdre and Mick, thank you very much indeed. 030 30 80 55 55. We'll hear from you next after the news. Right, let's hear from you now this morning, Fred. Morning, Fred.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I have three quick points here. Point one, Mike Nesbitt, Minister for Health, has turned around and said he cannot fix waiting lists and pay the nurses the pay raise which they deserve with the budget he has. Point two is on infrastructure and transport. The glider service expansion has been scaled back. And point three, this money coming in, we're not raising money. If the executive go back to the store, or go back to UK and say, look, we need more money, we're told you to raise your own funds first and we'll give you money. There's money sitting waiting there, Stephen, that could help this country. We're not availing of it. And the reason we're not is because the politicians here are too stuck in their own ways and hell-bent and saying, no way, we're not doing this.
Fred, thank you very much. John Nixon, Lisburn. Morning, John.
Yeah, I think there needs to be more accountability. I mean, the fact that this has dragged on for years and years and years, and there has to be responsibility. And I worked for the government, and I'll not say which department, but you see, targets was the easiest targets. We need to start being responsible, getting people here to pay their way. And I'm speaking really for the people that want to pay their way, especially the low-paid people. They're being pilloried. They're coming to the food bank where I volunteer because they can't make ends meet. And at the same time, you've got people living off the welfare state, not wanting to contribute anything, not wanting to give anything to this wee country of ours. And we need accountability and responsibility up in the hill and in the government departments. That's all I want to say.
Thank you. Graham, morning, Graham.
Good morning, Stevie. Listen, I must admit, I could not believe Mick Fieldy this morning actually giving these people credit for this. That's the problem. We give people credit for mediocrity, and this is well below mediocrity. This is an atrocious thing. And well-timed, of course. It's the usual Stormont meal, isn't it? Waffles with fudge on top. They'll get nothing done between the next election. Give themselves a pay raise and we'll elect these people again. We'll go down the same hole and the same spiral of degradation, and people will die. Simple.
Well, they do in this document set out targets for social housing. So you will be able to at least hold them accountable around that. And they say that good housing is essential to Greymouth health and well-being. They do set up targets for that.
Listen to what he called that. There's nothing in that document we don't already know. There's not.
Well, how do you know? Nothing, you haven't seen it.
Well, what do you tell me? I'm taking you as your word. I mean, are you telling me lies? I mean, it's very much aspirational. And I mean, you know what aspirations you're going to get after that? You're going to get absolutely nothing. We're going to pay it through the nose. They're going to want a pay raise, you know, at the end of the month or whatever, at the end of the year. And we'll be back down the same old Mickey Marty's roundabout. This is ridiculous. They've done 25 years and exactly what have they done? Is our health service better? Is our education service better? Are there people off the waiting list? You know, is mental health any better? Nothing, nothing, nothing.
Graham, thank you very much indeed. Look, when I'm out and about travelling around the place now and I walk into businesses or whatever, I'm urged to keep asking questions around the whole disaster that there is in Northern Ireland of gridlock, because our planning system is saying that they can't agree many projects because our water infrastructure system cannot cope with it. And so you look at this and the politicians are aware of it, and that's more than a business and a planning application. That's about employment. That's about prosperity. That's about being able to build homes. The water infrastructure system permeates through a lot of issues in this country. And there is basically diddly squat in this in terms of how they're going to solve it. What they do tell you is the problem. So it's taken them a year to tell you what the problem is rather than solve it. So I want to read to you the page under Building New Foundations just one more time so that I'm being fair to them. So you tell me after I've read this if this is a milestone programme for government spelling out how they've agreed to fix our water infrastructure system. I want to read these three paragraphs to you. They say, improving our infrastructure will be vital to delivering our priorities. By investing in water and wastewater, roads and transport, and sporting infrastructure, we will encourage businesses to invest, enable house building, and support greater energy efficiency and affordability. These investments will also improve our sporting infrastructure, helping to create a healthier society and attract world-class events. We know that public investment alone is not enough, and we will continue to implement a planning improvement programme in collaboration with local government and other stakeholders. Our goal is to make our planning system work for businesses, people and the environment. Any figures? Are you noticing that there's no figures there? Are you noticing that they haven't actually told you how they're going to improve the water and wastewater disaster that we have in this country? Have you noticed there's no timeline? Have you noticed there's no date? Gareth, morning, Gareth. Good morning, Gareth.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Why couldn't you have held your own water for 3 hours? Speaking of water, Stephen, you are effectively in contempt of the Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly. You would be given off whenever ministers are talking about things before they're officially announced in the Assembly. And you have fallen for this leak. You just simply couldn't help yourself. Could you, for the sake of 3 hours until it is officially announced?
What are you on about?
The public cannot see what you're seeing. You're talking about something before it has officially been announced in the Northern Ireland Assembly because some idiot has leaked it to you. So, of course, it shouldn't have been leaked in the first place. But as a public service broadcaster, why could the BBC not have held off for 3 hours until it is officially announced in the Northern Ireland Assembly, as the Speaker of the Assembly has previously specified?
Well, do you know what you need to do, Gareth? What you need to do, and you're entitled to your opinion, you need to spend the day on the phone and start ringing the Times and the Daily Telegraph and every media organisation in the world and tell them, oh, they've been breaking a story and they should wait until it's actually delivered.
Hold on a second,
are you for
Stephen.
Real? Are you
hold
for
on a
real?
Second. It's only 3 hours. What you're doing is you're affecting the discourse in the Assembly. You're affecting the debates that are going to be taking place on this programme for government, and that does not fulfil the remit of a public service broadcaster.
What are you doing?
I am concerned, Stephen.
What are you? Why are you talking about it now, then?
I am not talking about it because I haven't seen it. The public hasn't seen it. You have a leaked copy. It is commentator's corner. The commentators can't help themselves. You can't help yourself for the sake of 3 hours until it is officially announced in the Northern Ireland Assembly.
Are you interested that there's no date, timeline, worked out procedure as to how they're going to fix our water? Are you interested in those children with special educational needs, where there is not a strategy agreed by our government? They're going to try to agree
one.
Hold on
a wee minute. I am interested in hearing from our executive office. I am interested in hearing from our ministers. I respect the role of the Speaker, who has already said that these announcements should be done through the a chamber of the Assembly, but you just can't help yourself for 3 hours, can you, Stephen?
Thank you, Gareth. Morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55, the number to call this morning. It's 18 minutes to 10. The Prime Minister's announced that the missile factory in Belfast is to supply 5,000 air defence missiles to Ukraine. The deal's worth up to $1.6 billion and will involve recruiting 200 additional staff. Here's the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer.
Yesterday evening, the UK signed a £2.2 billion loan to provide more military aid to Ukraine, backed not by the British taxpayer, but by the profits from frozen Russian assets. And today I'm announcing a new deal, which allows Ukraine to use £1.6 billion of UK export finance to buy more than 5,000 air defence missiles, which will be made in Belfast, creating jobs in our brilliant defence sector. This will be vital for protecting critical infrastructure now and strengthening Ukraine in securing the peace when it comes.
The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, gave this reaction to Good Morning Ulster.
This is hugely significant. There's no point talking about international principles, no point talking about the values that we respect and that we wish to protect globally if you're not prepared to stand up for them. And the work that TALIS do in Belfast is hugely significant. Ukraine would have fallen if it hadn't been for NLAWs sent in January 2022 from TALIS in Belfast, recognised internationally long before the US sent javelins or the use of LMMs came into play with this order yesterday and with deliveries over the last couple of years. We're given the tools to make sure that a sovereign country has the ability to stand against an international aggressor in Russia, a country that decided to walk over the border, destroy cities and villages and towns, and kill civilians. So those are the values that we're protecting and defending, and I'm pleased that Belfast plays its role in that.
It's Gavin Robinson this morning. Our economics and business editor, John Campbell, with us now. How significant is this, John?
Well, it's a very, very big order indeed. It's the single largest order the TALIS factory has ever had. I can't think in the recent past of a single order being announced for a company which has required them to hire 200 additional staff to complete it. So just to again, clarify the size of this, initially worth over £1 billion, with potential that it could be worth a further £500 million. Most of that work will be done in Belfast. Some of it will be done with a partner company in Ukraine. But this is a very large order indeed. It's worth saying that this is not the first order that TALIS has done for Ukrainian armed forces. So from the very start of the war, the Ukrainian armed forces have been using a weapon made by TALIS called the NLAW, which is like a shoulder-fired anti-tank weapon. That was kind of the iconic weapon, really, in the early stages of the war. And then just before Christmas, TALIS started delivering some of these LMMs, as they're called, lightweight multimodal missiles. That's a bit of a mouthful. They started sending those just before Christmas. But what we have now is a much, much bigger order for those. I think the initial order was around 650. This order is for 5,000 of those, and they are due to be used in Ukrainian air defence systems. So they'll be used to try and do things like shoot down Russian drones.
How long will the jobs be for, these new jobs?
Do not know, but we know that the Prime Minister also last week talked about generally ramping up defence spending in the UK in the longer term, so aiming, I think, to get it to over 2.5% of UK national income in the next couple of years, then aiming for 3% of national income. So clearly he is intending to spend more on things of this sort. And in terms of the sort of work Talais do, that is a kind of defence manufacturing that you can probably ramp up fairly quickly. Whereas if you compare, say, something like Harland and Wolff when it comes to making ships for the Royal Navy, that's a kind of a much slower process of ramp up. You know, effectively their yard will be tied up with an existing contract which they have over the next few years. So I suppose, you know, part of you will think, well, are these going to be temporary type positions? But if you think about the overall plan for defence spending in the coming years, they may be more sustainable.
I noticed that Talley's share price went up 13% this morning, John. So could Northern Ireland, as there's more and more talk about defences around the world, there was some Five Live last night, we're talking about this non-stop, of how governments are going to have to increase their defence budgets. Could Belfast become a centre of excellence with this missile factory in the middle of it?
There'd be an enormous amount of work to do on that score. There's actually not that much percentage-wise of the UK defence procurement budget which is spent in Northern Ireland. Really, there's Thales, there's Harland & Wolff, Spirit Aerosystems do a bit, and then there's some in that supply chain. But in, you know, in percentage terms, we only get a very small fraction. Various reasons for that, and I know that it has been studied about how Northern Ireland can maybe get a bit more of that. But you're starting from a kind of long way back. If you think, you know, of the big UK defence company, BAE Systems, for example, they don't have a presence in Northern Ireland, and you tend to have a lot of spending and a cluster of companies in the southeast of England. So that there is some potential there for Northern Ireland, you know, some catch-up growth, but our kind of defence industries overall, for various reasons, are much smaller than in other parts of the UK.
John Campbell, thank you very much. Professor David Galbraith is Professor of War and Technology at the University of Bath and an international security expert. Morning to you, David.
Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. So, does this make us a target now for hackers if we're creating missiles to target enemy states? How much does Belfast become a target, or does it not work like that?
Well, I mean, it could work like that, but I think that as we've seen in the past, probably what we're likely to see more than anything else, if we see anything, is we're likely to see, in a sense, much more material, kind of old-style sabotage. Much more so than, because effectively that's just much easier than actually trying to get through cyber defenses that not only Talais will be very developed and very resilient with, but also trying to get around things like GCHQ and things like this. So actually, in a sense, old fashioned sabotage is more likely.
Now, old fashioned sabotage, what does that mean?
Well, a good example would be something like that happened in Germany back in 2022, which is where we saw these storage warehouses being set on fire, essentially. Now, the initial understanding was is that these perhaps, you know, something happened inside the warehouses. But what we later found out is actually we think that the FSB, which is the kind of the secret or the intelligence service in Russia, probably was responsible for those fires. Again, that is not something that is done through a network, through the internet, but actually is something that is somebody has walked up to the building and put in an accelerant and set the building on fire.
So how do you... how do you protect against that?
Well, ordinarily we were protected through just general intelligence, and so military and police intelligence in the UK is really primed for this sort of thing. And of course, this is something that Britain was considerably concerned about during the Cold War period, because this is the same thing, you know, it's just a continuation. In fact, it's even the same adversary for the most part, a continuation of the way the standard operating procedures that you would have within then Soviet to now Russian intelligence services. So the really the opportunity that we have, not only in the Southeast, where there's lots of defense industry, and also the Southwest, where I'm based, which also has a lot of defense industry, but also in Northern Ireland, there's a feeling that both the material state and also the cyber state of both of those defense industries is really quite sophisticated, and that means that effectively we're unlikely to see something very specifically targeted towards something like Belfast or even in Bristol, very near me, for instance, in the foreseeable future.
David, sorry if I'm being stupid about this, but I'm trying to understand why the likes of the Russians would not be targeting the actual base where the missiles against them are being made.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I take your point that there's just a question of why wouldn't the Russians try to go to the source, if you will. Well, the one thing to say is that that Talos factory also makes makes LMMs for the Royal Navy. So especially the helicopters that the Royal Navy uses. That means that actually it's considered a much more provocative move to target in defense industries in the UK, which will have, in a sense, multiple clients, if you will, not only the Ukrainians, but also the British. So it would be, in a sense, a provoking of the UK to actually become much more involved in the Ukraine war. And actually, that's not what Russia wants. Russia wants the UK and France and other European states to get bored of Ukraine, to not be interested, to not see it as an existential threat, to, in a sense, encourage Ukraine to agree to the exchange of peace or to the lack of security guarantees and so on. That's what Russia really wants. It doesn't seek to escalate necessarily in this way. And by and large, European states, where big defense industries are located, have been really resilient in relation to any kind of threat from the FSB or any other kind of security service in Russia.
You no doubt saw the events unfold in the White House and the Oval Office, David. Mm. Do you think we're closer or further away from a war spreading now?
I think that probably we're not changed, or we haven't changed in terms of a war spreading. I think there is a considerable case to be made that actually the longer that the war goes on, the more likely that it could spill over into something else. And we do know in the literature looking at wars that that they are contagious, and that means that actually they often spill over borders and move to other areas. The feeling that we, you know, the feeling that we may be less secure because Trump is in the White House, I think, is a well-founded feeling. The real issue, I think, is that do we think that actually the war as it exists within Ukraine at the moment has fundamentally changed? And actually, it really hasn't at the moment. It hasn't changed. We may see that actually come September time that things look worse for Ukraine as, in a sense, American weapons start to run out or be, in a sense, taken back to the United States. But fundamentally, we don't see a real change at the moment. But that's what we're trying to, you know, that's what the government is trying to, engage and cooperate with other European states to make sure that doesn't happen.
Have a listen to Bill in Belfast calling us this morning. Morning, Bill.
Morning, Stephen. That's exactly what I'm ringing about. Who's to say there was an announcement in the press that there was a Russian submarine 6 miles off the coast of Donaghadee. It was in the papers. Who's to say that Russia won't say, right, they're making rockets to fire at us. Right, we'll take out their rocket factory with a cruise missile. They're building ships for the Royal Navy. We'll take that out too. And it's no use saying the Russians aren't thinking like that. It's war. and especially when our Prime Minister wants to put boots on the floor. So a tactical strike or a cruise missile will take that factory out and take the shipyard out, no matter what that gentleman says. He's trying to think for the Russians. I'm trying to think for me.
He's an international security expert, and he's Professor of War and Technology at the University of Bath. Let me let David respond.
They've never got anything wrong then?
Go ahead, David.
No, I mean, I think that that's it's a good question in a sense. Why wouldn't the Russians do that? Because if the Russians see that they are in war with NATO or European NATO at least, why wouldn't they try to do something like that? Well, it has been the case that actually we didn't see that sort of thing throughout the Cold War, when they definitely felt that they were at war with Britain as a NATO member. And so it'd be unlikely that we saw that that level of aggression. Now, if we're talking about actually using cruise missiles against urban spaces in Britain, that is essentially a declaration of war. And that's a declaration of war, actually, that goes far beyond the idea of, in a sense, harassment, as we see in terms of both sea and air, as we see, in a sense, these interdictions that are happening both at sea and air. So I feel that actually we're talking about two levels of threat that we just don't experience in the UK and haven't experienced really since the Second World War.
Just to come back at that, gentleman, Ukraine is going to be firing rockets into Russia. So Russia's going to say, oh, well, we'll not do that because it'll cause an international racket. If Ukraine's firing rockets into Russia, do you not think Russia's going to hit back and say, right, well, we know where they're made? That's just my thoughts.
Okay, Bill, thank you. You're clearly worried about it. David, before you go this morning, we've seen the Prime Minister saying that Europe needs to step up now in terms of giving security protections to Ukraine. And it all looked very carefully worded last night, until you start thinking, well, step up and be ready to do what? Be ready to attack who?
Yeah, I think that there's a real... these things haven't really been fleshed out very well, because we don't really know what the future is going to hold for Ukraine. I think the idea is that we assume that Ukraine will come to a peace eventually that actually doesn't include all of the Ukrainian territory that it had prior to 2014, and that actually the security guarantees that either Europe or European NATO or bilateral guarantees which may develop means that actually we may have basing in Ukraine. That means that actually that British, but also perhaps French, perhaps even German or Danish soldiers being based in Ukraine to essentially to make sure that there's always a cost to be paid should Russia try to do anything in the future.
Okay. David, really helpful. Thank you very much indeed. The 10 o'clock news is coming up right now. Good morning, it's the Nolan Show from the BBC this Monday morning. Hope you're well. Well, Friday night, unbelievable, extraordinary. After President Zelensky was essentially kicked out of the White House after a row in the Oval Office between him, J.D. Vance, the Vice President, and President Trump. They were supposed to be discussing possible options to end the war with Russia, but it all turned very, very ugly. Let's have a listen.
You're right now not in a very good position. You've allowed yourself to be in a very bad position, and he happens to be right about it.
From the very beginning of the war,
you're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having cards.
I'm not playing cards.
Right now, you don't.
You're
playing cards,
Mr. President.
You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country, that's backed you far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Have you said thank you once this entire meeting? No, in this entire meeting, have you said thank you? You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Please, you think that if you will speak very loudly about the war, you
He's
can...
He's not speaking loudly. He's not speaking loudly. Your country's in big trouble.
Can I
Wait a minute. No, no. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning. I know. You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks in this cabinet, and not only in this cabinet.
We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted for your president.
We gave you military equipment, and your men are brave, but they had to use our military.
What about West?
If you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days. This is something
Maybe less.
In 2 weeks. Of course, yes.
It's going to be a very hard thing to do business like this.
Again,
I tell you.
Just say thank you. Except that there are disagreements, and let's go litigate those disagreements rather than trying to fight it out in the American media when you're wrong.
It's like a Nolan show right in the middle of the Oval Office, isn't it? Absolutely unprecedented, extraordinary, find whatever word you want. Jerry Carroll from People Before Profit. Morning to you, Jerry.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And Greg Swenson, Chairman of Republican Overseas UK. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, what do you make of President Trump's approach to that diplomacy, that diplomatic moment, Jerry?
Freddie, it was pretty remarkable, Stephen, and a bit stunned, to be honest with you, to see it played live on television on Freddie. I mean, my guess is this is the kind of posturing and language that probably goes on behind closed doors when the US are meeting other nations across the world. I mean, Trump is in many ways more bullish, more upfront and obscene about his imperialism, but I imagine in previous meetings with other countries, probably former presidents have been quite similar. But what was remarkable about it was that it was obviously played out in front of the world. And for me, really, this is all about the US trying to pivot towards China. China is the biggest threat for the US interests. They want to at least see China as a threat, as a growing economy, and obviously the US is still the biggest imperial power in the world, but China is a much more dangerous threat to them than Russia, Russia and Ukraine, or Russia generally. So this is about finishing the war on the US's terms primarily, and that's a problematic thing to happen in terms of there's been talk of a peace deal that will lead to the privatization of a lot of the services in Ukraine and so on and so forth. But this is about the US and Trump really pivoting towards China, which would be really, really dangerous and devastating for people right across the world.
Greg?
You know, there's no doubt this is the president has a different style. And I think, you know, people, for most of us, have gotten used to that, you know, because he's been around for 8 years. But I think the tailspin on Friday only really started 40 minutes into the press conference. And that's what, you know, I think it's challenging to just listen to the clips like we just did of the last 5 or 10 minutes of the argument, what's called, on Friday. But, you know, for 40 minutes, it was a typical sort of, you know, well-delivered diplomatic press conference. And perhaps they should have kept it behind closed doors on some of the more sensitive issues. But I think this president's very transparent. But the other thing I'd remind the viewers or the listeners is, you know, there were three big meetings last week. One on Monday with Emmanuel Macron, one on Thursday with Keir Starmer, and then finally on Friday with Zelensky. And they were remarkably different in the sense that, you know, I think Macron and Keir Starmer did a much better job of reading the room and being diplomatic. And I know Zelensky's under some stress, needless to say, but, you know, he just didn't read the room. And I think he was really poking at the president until finally the president just couldn't take it anymore.
Is it time for Zelensky to concede that he won't get some territory back, Jerry, and attempt through compromise to bring an end to this war, or would that be him selling out his people given what they've been through?
Well, I think we need a peace deal, Stephen. It's obviously that ends the war. I think it's a priority. I mean, I think it's also quite concerning that in that context you have people like Keir Starmer and others who want to keep the war going at any cost. And, you know, this war has seen hundreds of thousands of people dead on both sides, millions of people forced to flee, and we should be saying the war should come to an end. And I don't trust any US presidents, but especially Trump, to have a deal that's going to be in the best interests of ordinary Ukrainians or even ordinary Russians in the area. But a peace deal is what is needed, rather than, you know, war leaders pouring more petrol onto the fire and causing more death, more carnage and more destruction, and leaving the world in a more unstable and dangerous place.
Are you glad to see the 1.6 billion that's coming to Northern Ireland, Gerry? 200 more jobs for the missiles.
Not really, Stephen. I mean, I think really it shows a priority of the British government. Like I was saying, I mean, this comes just off the back of a few days ago. They cut the foreign aid, which is government aid going to some of the most poorest countries in the world, probably countries ruined by the history of the British empire and imperialism. And rather than having 200 jobs going to, say, the housing executive to try and deal with the housing crisis that we hear every single day, that I face every single day in my constituency office, and we're seeing 200 jobs going to help keep the war going. And there's not 200 jobs going to councils to help with local services. There's not, I mean, could you imagine 200 jobs and £1.6 billion going into the health service? It would be transformative. But this is really about Keir Starmer keeping the war going at any cost. And really, it's potentially putting people at risk. It's a dangerous thing. And like I said, it shows the priorities of this government, and they should be dealing with the crises that people face here, and rather than putting more weapons and pouring more petrol on the fire that has been a devastating war for the last 3 years.
Okay. Gerry, thank you very much. Greg, thank you. All the best. Leonard and Lurgan. Morning, Leonard.
Yeah. And just listening to what's all happening there, and they're calling the Ukrainian president a dictator. Is the people afraid to stand up against him? Because if, when I was in
the... Are you talking about the Russian president, Putin? Is that
no,
what you mean?
No.
You mean Zelensky?
Zelensky, aye.
Okay.
I can't understand, when you have a meeting, you go one to one. If you have somebody else on the other side, two on the other side, you're not having a meeting. You're having two bully boys telling you what to do. And then Trump with somebody in the crowd, some newsreader, asking him, does he not have a suit? It's just, it's unbelievable that they're letting Trump away with all this here.
So you think that Zelensky was bullied in that Oval Office meeting, do you?
Well, the television thing I was watching, he was definitely bullied. And somebody wants to tell Trump, he's talking about the great war machine. They never won a war on their own in their life.
0-30-30-80-55-55. Now, last week, if you remember, I promised you that we would have a look at hip and knee surgery because so many of you, no doubt, as you're getting older, your hips start to get sore, your knees start to get sore. So if you don't have the money to go private, where will you be left in later life? Well, figures released by the Department of Health show that just over 15,000 people are waiting for a first consultant-led outpatient appointment by orthopaedics. But what do these surgeries involve? What are the average age of patients? And what is the recovery like? Chris Tulloch is an orthopaedic surgeon who spent 45 years working in the NHS. Chris, good morning.
Good morning.
That's a lifetime. That's
a lifetime.
A lifetime,
yeah.
I've been on your feet, Chris. Are your knees sore?
No, my hip is, though.
Right, okay. So what is happening? Look, bit of self-interest here. I'm 52, I'm fat, my hips are sore all of a sudden, and I'm wondering what's happening in my body and what's ahead of me. And I hear so many people of a certain age in their 50s and 60s either talking about their hips or their knees. So what's going on, Chris, in our bodies?
Well, unfortunately, our joints do wear out. Possibly being overweight increases that, but I've never been completely convinced because I see some patients who are very thin who have worn out hips. Probably we're not designed to live as long as we are living now. And it's just a purely mechanical effect.
So how do they wear out? What does that mean? Are they rubbing against each other or what's going on?
Well, the bearing surface is stuff called cartilage, which is very low friction bearing. It is beautiful, smooth, and when it's young and healthy. But it gets harder with age and then gradually wears away and becomes rough. And then eventually it wears away, so it's gone completely. and you've just got bone rubbing on bone.
And then how is it fixed when we get this surgery? Does this apply to our knees as well as our hips?
Yeah, exactly the same process. In knees, it's more often a result of direct injury. So you injure your knee when you're a teenager or a young adult playing football or whatever, and that damages the what we call the meniscus, which is a little interspace thing, filler, to make the surfaces more congruent.
And so when we get the surgery, what is the surgeon doing?
Basically, for total joint replacement, we replace the surfaces. So we change it to metal on plastic. So instead of being bone on bone, it's metal on plastic.
What do you mean? Where's the metal? The metal is going on top of the bone or what?
Yeah. Well, there are different ways of doing it, but often we'll put a metal stem down the femur after taking the head off, which will have a ball on top of it. And then the cup, the acetabulum, is replaced with a shell with a plastic liner. When I say plastic, it's high-density polyethylene.
And what's the success rate of these operations?
Extremely good, extremely high. We get interested in results at 10 years from initial surgery, and we're looking at 90%+ success at 10 years. You know, it's a very, very successful procedure.
And the reason that's really interesting is because it's money then that's coming in between, given the success rate, people living in pain and people having a statistically fantastic chance of being pain-free. It's money.
Yeah. It's also it is money, but it's also the resources in terms of the staff that you need to do it. You know, I've never done a hip replacement on my own. It's always part of a team.
Have I seen an operator? Are you going in there with is it a pretty brutal when you get in there smashing up bone or whatever in the old hip, or what are you doing? Talk me through the operation. Yeah, I think I've seen a video of this.
Yeah, well, it's probably best if patients don't watch videos of it, because I think it is pretty brutal. Yes, but frankly, yes.
So what are you doing? Talk me through what you do.
Well, for a hip replacement, first of all, you have to get down to the hip joint, which is relatively simple. There are roots in. Then you dislocate the hip, so you take the ball out of the socket, and then cut off the top of the femur to cut off the ball part, and then that gives you access to the cup, to the acetabulum. So you ream that to a certain size, grind it out with power tools.
And is that where I've seen the tools being used?
Yeah. It's, an orthopedic surgeon is often described someone who's happy with a knife and a power tool.
Wow. What's the recovery time like?
It has changed dramatically over the past few years. We're now doing a lot of surgery as either a day case surgery, so you're coming in the morning, you're out that evening, or you're coming in the morning, you're out the next day.
And how long would people be out of work for?
12 weeks.
What can we do? Like, I'm looking at the waiting list here in Northern Ireland. The Department of Health have told us, the Belfast Trust have told us, that as of February of last year, the longest waiting patient requiring hip surgery was 445 weeks. Imagine living in pain.
Is that right?
8 years.
It could well be right. I'm not aware of the specific details for Northern Ireland, but I have been aware for many years that Northern Ireland have a problem with a long, very long waiting list. And the answer to it really is separating elective orthopaedic surgery, so doing joint replacement surgery, shoulder surgery, whatever, it doesn't matter, from emergency surgery, because emergency surgery will always take priority in a hospital. So you need to put up facilities where you're doing your elective surgery in a separate building, completely separated, so that there's no emergency patients coming in using the beds and the facilities. So you can plan exactly what you're going to do. And then you can get more efficiency, because you then have a group of surgeons and a group of theatre staff and a group of physiotherapists and ward staff who are all used to a very rapid turnover. you get the teamwork, and the teamwork, I've got to emphasize again and again, is the most vital part of it. So the team know, they knew what I was going to do before I did it.
Wow. Look, really, really interesting stuff, Chris, and thank you for talking us through it. Really appreciate it. I just looked at this as a misprint, and it's not. 445 weeks waiting for hip surgery in the Belfast Trust. As of the 24th of February, 24, they say. 8 years! They say there are currently 2,065 patients awaiting hip surgery. In terms of knee surgery, 365 weeks. It's interesting that they're summing this up in weeks. So we've got to divide, obviously, by 50. 7 years. Someone's waiting for knee surgery. 7 years. And those figures include patients referred from the Northern and Southeastern Trusts, the Southern Trust. They've been in touch with us. Longest person waiting for a hip replacement within the Southern Trust. 372, 7 years. 8 years for a knee replacement. And then they're telling you the NHS is free at the point of delivery. It's a difference between money and not money. It's a difference between being able to get a private hip replacement, a private knee replacement. But if you're in the working class, if you're working as hard as anyone else and your money's depleted at the end of the month, by the time you pay your childcare, by the time you get a uniform on your child's back and all of that, you'll be waiting 8 weeks, 8 years for a knee replacement, 7 years for a hip replacement in the Southern Trust, 8 years in the Belfast Trust. My goodness. Alan Stout from the BMA. Morning to you.
Morning, Simon.
And the pain, you're chair of the BMA, the pain that's associated with this can be quite acute, debilitating and life-limiting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is life-changing surgery for some patients. Do you know, those figures that you're quoting, I suspect they're even worse than that, because I think what they're counting there is the time from assessment by the consultant in an outpatient clinic to the surgery. Now, the patient will actually have already waited maybe as long as 3, 4, or 5 years that assessment from the time of referral.
It's just outrageous. Interesting that they've backdated those figures actually to February 24. Why aren't they giving us 2025 figures? I think you make a fair point. So you're telling me people could be waiting over 10 years for a hip replacement, Alan?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you got to think of the category of person that is going for this sort of surgery. So it tends to be the older people, as you say, they will have paid into the health service, they will have paid their taxes for their entire life. But also they're at the time that this will make such a big difference, you know, and it's whether you live out your life in pain and with reduced movement, reduced socializing and everything else that comes with that, or whether you can have what is life-changing intervention and surgery. And as Chris said, is extremely successful, you know, and people do, if it's done at the right time and done early enough, it does tend to lead to a very good and relatively short recovery as well.
Much does a hip replacement cost, Chris, in the private sector?
About £10,000, £12,000.
Right.
So the point I was trying to make is that the people who do the surgery in the private sector have all been trained in the National Health Service and nearly always will be working both sectors. So the fact they're working in the private sector reduces their ability to do sessions in the National Health Service.
Well, it's that argument again, isn't it? That, you know, are they free to do whatever they want in their free time? The argument that they can be paid a lot more in certain other health economies. So therefore, them being able to make more money in the private sector and work in the NHS,
of course,
might be the right mix.
But you're restricted in the hours you can drive a lorry, you're restricted in the hours you can drive a bus, but you're not restricted in the hours you can do surgery in. So do you want your surgeon, you know, doing your operation at 10 o'clock at night when he should be sitting down on a glass of Guinness and relaxing?
Surely there must be a maximum amount of hours a surgeon can work.
Nope.
No.
Nope. When I was training, I went down to watch a surgeon in London, and he did an operation in the private sector starting at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Whoa. Philip, you're 65.
Yes.
Good morning. You're in pain, Philip.
I'm in pain. I'm on the list to have surgery on my left knee.
How long have you been waiting?
I was saw by a consultant in Craigavon last year, and he said it'd be another 4 years before I'd be seen.
How bad's the pain, Philip?
It's, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's about a 5. I had my right knee replaced 4 years ago. That was when it was at a number 10 on the pain level.
You must be angry.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, NHS England give a waiting time list of 18 weeks for non-urgent referrals for surgery. Northern Ireland, there's years and years and years. And successive assemblies have come and gone and done nothing to do anything about the health service here.
Oh, I'm looking through the programme for government document as you're talking to me. As you're one of the people that I'm representing, you're sitting on a waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just looking here for any clear, well thought through, as Michelle O'Neill has called this document, milestone for what they're going to do about waiting lists. I don't think
you've found anything.
No. They tell you there's a problem. They tell you that with executive support, invest up to $135 million a year, but it's not in the budget.
But it's not a programme for government. A programme for government tells people what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. That's just blue sky thinking.
We've contacted the Department of Finance this morning, and we're asking them, how come? Because their minister will have signed this off along with every other minister. And we have asked the Department of Finance, how come this $135 million is not in the draft budget for 25-26? How come?
Where are they going to get it from? The Assembly has no revenue-raising power, so where are they going to raise this $100?
They've set a target of an additional 70,000 patients and a further $80 million a year to increase elective care capacity through expansion of elective care. Okay. This all joins up. This all joins up as you're hearing about the programme for government in the news today. It all joins up. If that programme for government is not comprehensive, is not detailed, then people like Philip sit and continue to sit in pain. Avril and Coleraine, last call of the day. Morning.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Go ahead, Avril.
No, I'm just ringing and I was listening to your programme there. It was great interest. Yes, I waited 9 years for a new knee.
Yeah, 9 years?
9 years, yeah. Yeah, 9 years, and I got it done 6 months ago. Wonderful surgeon and great success.
Life-changing, right?
Yes, yes. But, I'm telling you, I know what people are like. The suffering was unbelievable for me, Stephen.
Well, I'm bringing it back to the top story today. I'm looking at the programme for government. Are the next set of people going to be waiting for 9 years? Let's see what promises they set out today when they announce this in the Assembly. Thank you, Avril. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Alan. Thank you very much indeed for listening today. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.